that doesn't mean that the industries are evil or that we need to shut things down. What we do need to think about is, what are we doing to allow for a livable planet and for safe and secure communities? And how much do we need? And how much greed are we going to allow in our society?
Forgotten Corner podcast would not exist without our listeners. If you enjoy the work we are doing on this show and would like to support further, please consider a donation through our Patreon account, patreon.com/forgottencornerpod, or visit our website, forgottencornerpod.com.
Welcome back to the Forgotten Corner podcast. We acknowledge that the Forgotten Corner occupies unceded Indigenous land. We acknowledge that the Blackfoot Confederacy never surrendered its land in the signing of Treaty 7, but agreed to share it. The Forgotten Corner sits on Treaty 7 and Treaty 4 territory, traditional lands of the Siksika, Kainai, Piikani, Stony Nakoda, and Tsuut'ina, as well as the Cree, Sioux, and the Soto bands of the Ojibwa peoples. We also honor and acknowledge that we are on the Métis Nation within Region 3. The Forgotten Corner is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network, and as always, if you'd like to check out other progressive podcasts such as this, click the link we will provide in our show notes, and there's plenty of great shows to choose from. My name is Scott Schmidt. I am your host today. Normally, I'm here alongside co-host Jeremy Appel, but he is finally finishing off the move to Edmonton that we've been discussing for a couple of months here. So he's legitimately sort of neck deep in boxes and disarray and probably doesn't have even the means to join a Zoom call at the moment. So and editor producer Mo Cranker is kind of here, but he won't let me talk to him because I have his mic at my house right now. So it's really just me sitting here bantering to myself. And I just finished watching Canada get cranked by Croatia in the World Cup. So we're just going to just jump into an even bigger disaster of a situation, and that would be Alberta politics. And we have a really cool show for you guys today, so I won't bother you with telling you about my week, which is boring, and we're just going to jump right into it. So Jordan Wilkie is the leader of the Green Party of Alberta, one of several provincial parties looking to chip away at what seems to be a two-party situation in the province at the moment. He's held the role since 2020, taking over a party in a bit of a fixer-upper stage. The Forgotten Corner welcomes Mr. Wilkie to the show this week, where we will discuss plenty about his party, what drew him to it, and what he and his team have planned in the lead-up to the spring general election. However, outside politics, this born and raised Edmontonian has more than 15 years experience in emergency services. A firefighter for the past 14 years, this career has seen him respond to some of the worst disasters in Alberta's history. And if you think about that, considering the political landscape he's just entered into, he might just be the most qualified party leader this province has. So we have a lot to talk about, and we're very happy to have him here. Mr. Wilkie, welcome to the Forgotten Corner.
Absolutely an honor to be here. Thank you so much. Myself coming in from Treaty 6 here, Métis Region 4, and I appreciate that land acknowledgement, Scott.
Absolutely. Well, and we like to make sure that, and lots of guests come on and do their own as well, so that's great. And so let's kind of just jump into it. How's your weekend going, first of all?
Oh, yeah. So shift working, we don't really have weekends. It's actually, it's mostly... Is it busy when you go out or not? And then you know, okay, it's the weekend. Everyone's out, you know, trying to have some fun for the weekend. But yeah, no, it's for me day three. So I've had a few days off. Yeah. Got some hockey in. I got some time with the family. So it's been a good 6 days off, and then I'm back on shift on Monday.
Sounds very typical Albertan Canadian kind of activities to be doing: play a little hockey, hang out with the family. So. You've obviously had like quite an interesting life, certainly an interesting career. And when we have guests on at the Forgotten Corner, It's imperative that our guests know who exactly they're listening to and who we're talking to. And so this is kind of life story time. Go back and we know you were born in Edmonton. Just tell us a little bit about your upbringing and what kind of sort of like a childhood situation you had.
All right, cool. Yeah. I was born here and we moved to Ontario. We were following around the family business. My grandfather was in aviation. And my father is ex-oiler, actually. He played goal for the oil back when they were in the WHA. But that was all long gone. He was a lawyer. Our family was quite conservative. I would say middle C conservative family. And yeah, I mean, life was good. And I had a certain level of privilege in my life. I'd say middle class, and we've always been well brought up to give back when we can, to share what we can, to do what we can for the people and for one another, because we're all interconnected. At the end of the day, we're all family. And so, yeah, I've always wanted to be a firefighter. It was my first word was truck, because I had a fire truck. So I'm that kid that wanted to be a firefighter, and that never left me. It actually only got stronger. And then I did some volunteer shifts. I did a co-op through high school with fire and in the emergency services. And, that's around the time where people started to actually telling me I would never do it. I would never get there.
It's a weird thing to be like, you can't have
you can't have your dream, right?
Right. Yeah. It's one thing if your dream is like, I'm gonna, play in the NHL, or I'm gonna like cure cancer or something like that, but it's like fairly attainable. I want to be a firefighter.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not the biggest guy. I have just a big work ethic and I'm fit and all good, but like there's this preconceived conception of what a firefighter is, or what a politician is, or whatever it is. And, people love to tell you, you can't do it. And so, it was around high school where people were really telling me, I had friends that tried, like it's too hard. And it's just too hard. Just sit back, do it, go do business. I don't know what.
Right.
And of course that just pushes you forward and you say, F that. This is my dream. This is why I'm here on this planet. I've always wanted to help people. I've always wanted to save a life. I always wanted to create that ripple of something good.
Was there anything that sort of triggered this passion? Because I mean, you did allude to it, like every young sort of typical young boy wants to be a firefighter, right? Like that's sort of the thing we all talk, and it always is gone. And after a while, right? Like it's one of those top three things that everyone says that they want to become. Was there anything specific that sort of triggered something that just made it a passion that wouldn't stop burning? That was something that was bigger than sort of your, I want to have the cool red hat.
I think that there's a few things in there that I could talk about. Definitely with firefighting, no matter where you go or when you're called out, you're always there to help. Like, the police, they do a lot of good stuff. They help a lot, but they're also, they bust people and they're, it's not the same. It's not when, I looked in the military, I almost became a combat medic at one point, and I just couldn't get my head around hurting people. And so with firefighting, there's nothing like that. And it's one of those jobs where you put yourself on the line, and there's that team aspect, of course, that is so incredible. And it's, something that, as a medic, for example, I didn't have. You have a partner and there's a bit of a team aspect, but with firefighting, you really are in a squad with the other men and women. And it's really incredible to have that camaraderie and that sort of family style ability. You're going to work, but it feels like you're just hanging out with family. And of course, it's just a job that allows you to give back. And again, that's something that's always been a part of my upbringing. And it speaks to the level that you know, my family, we didn't live in scarcity. My parents were lucky enough to have pretty stable jobs. My mom is a teacher, my father is a lawyer. And you know, this is something that I think in a society, you see that if you can get past that scarcity, there's so much capacity to help one another and to do things that you've always wanted to do and dreamed about. So I was, again, in a very privileged situation where I could look forward and stay with this dream and do what it takes to get there. And of course, when people told me I couldn't do it or I was too small or all these things, that's just, you know, it gave me more fortitude to go back to my basics and how I felt in my heart.
Sure.
And what I needed to do with my life.
So before we get into some of the stuff that you've done when you became a firefighter, I just want to ask, like, your dad was a professional hockey player. Was there any part of you that sort of was looking to explore that route at any point in your life?
Hockey was huge in my family, and there was a bit of pressure because of my father playing. Although, you know, he was a goalie, and he wouldn't let me play goal because, again, he's just like, I won't do that to my son. Because again, there's so much pressure in those positions. But you know, I was a good hockey player, but there's just so many people out there that are just next level, you know. And it's all about, at the end of the day, for me, is you're pushing yourself, you're having fun, and you know, there's a bit of a rite of passage in Canada playing hockey. And I think that if you can find a healthy balance in your life, then that sport is incredible. But, you know, also you see in society that there's so much pressure on people to excel in things like hockey. And I think that we need to get back to basics of why we're doing some of these things.
100%.
Yeah.
So when you finished like high school, did you sort of go straight into like paramedic training kind of thing?
Yeah, I started recruiting fire. I was able to do a bit of traveling, which was great, to get out there and see the world. I spent some time in Japan, which was great. I fell in love with that culture and actually learned the language. I was pretty good at speaking Japanese until I got back to Canada and realized that there was no one to talk to for the most
right,
part.
Right.
However, long story short, yeah, I started recruiting. I started doing my training. I went down to Texas A&M and I did my firefighting down there. There's an incredible school out there that is just next level live fire training, and so that helped a lot, because in my first year of firefighting I was in some like worst case scenarios, bailing out of windows, having ceilings fall in on me and things like that. And I owe a lot of that extra training to my ability to kind of get out of those situations, and so that was pretty crucial. But it's hard, you know. People weren't lying when they said, oh, it's too hard. I mean, it's difficult. I started recruiting all over Canada. And while I did that, I was training to be, I was working part-time jobs and I was training to be an EMT as well, because that's a big stepping stone. One third of our calls are all medical. So, you know, having that patient contact and that background as an EMT is really crucial. And that's a really difficult job. And of course, in Alberta here, we've got a lot of issues around that. So I bring to the table a lot of background, you know, working frontline in these jobs. And I think it's kind of helped, you know, speak to where I am today and some of the issues that are happening in Alberta.
And really, firefighters are being first responders to scenarios that aren't necessarily a fire anymore, right? Like we have here, oh, yeah. Like, right. And my brother-in-law was a paramedic, and now he's a firefighter and head of the aquatic rescue in Medicine Hat here.
Right on.
But certainly, like, that was a, you know, a change that's happened in the last, you know, number of years or whatever, where firefighters are on hand to go. And so it's probably important that each one has that kind of training.
Yeah, it's crucial. And, you know, more so we're seeing for the first time actually in my career, or I've never even heard of it, is firefighters they're actually transporting, because of the lack of ambulances, because of the incredible burnout crisis that's happening in frontline staff like paramedics and nursing and things like this. But this is the first time we've ever been transporting patients in a fire truck. Like, fire trucks are not designed, as people know, to be transporting patients. And we've had in Edmonton here, we just had a big shift where we used to have an ambulance come to the fire in case one of us go down or someone at the fire needs help. they're not coming anymore. There's not enough ambulances to wait around, you know, and this is things that have never happened before. It speaks to the broken system that we're now in. Furthermore, the police just signed like kind of a memorandum of understanding that if they're hurt, they're just going to call fire, because ambulances are, you know, they can't depend that there's going to be an ambulance nearby. So things have really shifted. What we do
is that something you're seeing, like is it a daily occurrence? Is this a daily issue at this point?
Well, I mean, you know, when you're going to a fire and you're getting ready and you're getting your gear and your head straight, and then you hear over the radio, yeah, there's no ambulance coming. I mean, it creates that one extra thing where you're like, oh, good.
I hope
I don't fall through the floor on this one, you know?
Right.
Because things happen, and we're incredibly well trained, and our accountability systems are way better than they've used to be. Our safety mechanisms and our equipment is way better than they used to be. However, it's still, you know, the unknown is out there. And within the fire service, as you were alluding to, we do everything. And there's this kind of unspoken motto, adapt and overcome. And so again, that's a lot of what I've learned in the 14 years of my service, is you're going to an animal stuck in a vent, to an explosion on the north side, to a drowning victim, and you're trying to scoop someone out of a pond or something like that. It can just go from one thing to another, and then you're at a library reading to kids, you know.
Sure.
So and, it's full on.
You know, obviously we're past the point where people, you know, think of firefighting as sitting around playing cards until the bell goes off and you get to ride the pole and have a great day and the Dalmatian says goodbye and all that. But at what point, and maybe you guys have reached that, we talk about lots of jobs where, you know, they just keep piling on things that you have to do for, you know, forget the pay, but usually for not much more, for no more pay. And usually it's just people are stretched thin. We're very stretched thin, even where I am right now. It's like a handful, five people doing what, you know, 15 to 20 used to do when I first started there. And have you guys like approached that point where it's no longer adapt and overcome, where it's like, listen, we're actually literally overwhelmed here and can't keep up?
I think in some aspects, absolutely. I think when it comes to the opioid crisis and the poisoning drug disaster that is on the streets all across Alberta, including, you know, down in Medicine Hat there, we have massive issues that are systemic in nature, that of course sending a fire truck to it's just nothing. You're basically trying to put holes in a sinking ship, you know, to the water's coming through and there's holes everywhere and you're trying to plug it with your finger. That's what it feels like a lot of the times for us. The downtown halls here in Edmonton, they're going to overdoses almost every 30 minutes. And that's, again, this is not normal. This has been bad. And when COVID hit, there was no focus on the opioid crisis, and there was no media attention on it for quite some time, and it just got worse and worse and worse. So our resources are spread very thin, and the systemic issues around poverty, health, and dealing with some of the mental health crisis that we, you know, have on, you know, the streets and in the stations, these are all coming to fruition today. So to answer your question, yeah, it feels like that. I mean, we'll go out there and do our best. We've always got, you know, lots of support, and our union is, we have a very strong union, and they're fighting for us. And I think that it's just important to know that we can only do so much, and we can do the best of what we can. And, you know, a lot of my mental health issues, I've suffered from PTSD around some of the calls that I've been to. And when you look back on it, a lot of it was just not allowing yourself to say, okay, I did the best I could. When you've got a dead infant in your hand, that's hard thing to effing say, because it makes you think like, oh, I didn't do enough, I didn't care enough, and that weighs on people in these services. So again, battling the systemic issues, I think, is another reason why I think politics are so important right now. And I think that the political hyperpartisanship that is dividing us into these groups, we're getting away from the basics of helping other people and authentically showing up to say, okay, well, if poverty is a policy choice, what the hell are we doing wrong? And with a $13 billion surplus, what are we doing wrong? Like, how can we make a systemic change that is going to ripple through time? And I think that there's a moment right here where we need to stop and think about that, and think about how we vote in these next elections, and how we step up into, you know, becoming more involved in democracy, because the disenfranchisement of the people of Alberta, it's like, how much bad news can you take? How much, you know, Scott, like, you know, how many disasters can you watch until you just check out and
get it? Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that this is, there's a correlation here of these massive systemic issues and everyone going, well, I want to do something. I want to do my best with what I have, and then not having the tools. So I guess maybe that's a bit of a leeway into, you know, what we're doing here with the Green Party, wanting to push electoral reform so that we have a stronger democracy, so that we can get people out voting and not voting strategically, but voting for their values.
Yeah.
And so the big thing for me coming up here is that I've really been able to kind of look at, you know, not just my life and firefighting and helping others and my background as a, you know, having a master's in disaster emergency management. It's, you know, where are the systemic issues that can shift? And I think that starts a lot with how we vote, because how we vote literally will dictate the policy that will come through the legislature. And if we're pushing hyperpartisanship like the NDP and the UCP are, and we're not working together, we're not listening to Albertans, we're not listening to the diverse needs, then you're just going to push your agenda, and you're going to have another party in opposition saying that they're doing everything wrong and that they would be the solution. But what I say all the time is that you're never the full problem and you're never the full solution. And that's a lie. And people need to start working together in Alberta politics.
Now, before, that's well said. Sounds like almost rehearsed, well said, but no, it's kidding. But
a couple times now.
Yeah, that's right. No, it's well, it is well said. But before I go straight into the Green Party, like, can we just, and I know it's maybe tougher subjects because you have seen a lot and whatnot, but you were involved like on scene in Slave Lake, you were on scene at Fort Mac. Can we talk about that just a little bit, as far as sort of some of those things that you saw and just how that changed you? And then I'd like to even ask a little bit about whether, you know, what the access to mental health services there are for first responders in such a thing. But so was Slave Lake the first major, like, biggest holy shit? I mean, that's my math, that's got to be about 10 or 11 years ago now, right?
Yeah, that was pretty early in my career. I want to say I was 4 years on. So yeah, about 10 years. I think it was 2011. I'm just going to shoot that out there.
It was really early in my time at the news, and I started in 2010. So that,
right,
that checks.
Yeah. So again, like, yeah, I mean, Slave Lake, you go there and you just see that the overwhelming ability for nature to just shake off a town like they were a bug. You know, it's incredible to see the level of what a forest fire can do to a town. And that was my first real look at that. Like, I didn't do wildfire before. I was in the fire rescue here, urban, and we do it in the river valley and things like that. But being out there is a totally different story. But it really did, what Slave Lake really kind of got me into a path towards doing my master's in disaster emergency management, because what you see there is just this need of collaboration and participatory collaboration to come together and to really bring all the tools you need to face something that big and so overwhelming. So Slave Lake was a big introduction to that, you know, and it's at every level. It's the woman at the local motel that's just making some sandwiches, you know, for for us before we head out, and just seeing people coming together for a cause like that is always, you know, it does hit your heart, and you want to be, that's where you want to be. You want to be on those missions where everyone's coming together, especially from all across the province to help a town like Slave Lake. I mean, it's pretty cool to watch. And then that happened again in Calgary with the floods, and then in Fort Mac.
And Medicine Hat flooded the year Calgary did too, 2013. Yeah.
Many communities. Yeah. I mean,
my Calgary neighborhood was a lake
where we were.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. How was it for you?
Well, we're very like, so I was in a, for whatever reason, the house I'm in now that my wife had before we met was just on high enough ground that like literally a block in any direction was underwater, and like sewer backup was the only issue that she had. And where I was about four blocks away was just on a, like there was a house three doors down from me that was underwater. And it was, it's so weird how it flows. Like the baseball diamond here was like underwater up to the top, like two stories high. And, you know, we're probably only eight blocks from that building where we are, and it was dry here. But yeah, it was something else. Obviously the entire area was evacuated and zillions of damages, and they've spent the next 10 years building berms and flood mitigation to try to deal with what is no longer seemingly these once in a century floods.
Well, yeah, I mean, you said it right there, once in a century, right? These things are going to happen continuously. And so what does that say about where we're at, to the naysayers that think that Alberta is impervious to a changing climate and that we don't need to make a drastic shift towards creating climate stability and more resilience? These things are coming at us full force. And yeah, I mean, Fort Mac was a huge wake up call. For Fort Mac, I was supervising the shelter actually here in Edmonton. My crew went up, and because I volunteer with the Red Cross, I was sent to the shelter. So, and that was big too, because you had, you saw just how unprepared people were, people coming in without their shoes on, people coming in, no ID. They can't even get some of the support. Well, I mean, they got it, but you know, again, it was a logistical nightmare because everyone was just running out last second. And yeah, I mean, the biggest evacuation in Canadian history, right? So the logistical ramifications of that were immense. And, you know, being a part of that was, a calling. And I'm always honored to be, you know, part of these events. And I'm honored on every call to go to see people that are struggling or in a crisis scenario and just say, yeah, what can I do to help? It's a good feeling. And so again, it's something that I want to do on a higher level. I think that, you know, going to these events was big for me as far as my, I guess I didn't necessarily get into disaster management to get into politics.
Right.
It literally drove me there. It drove me there on many levels. Cause you see, okay, well, this is why don't we have the policy in place? Why do we have no vision towards the future and what's coming for us? Why is everything reactionary? You know, and then when you get into politics, you go, oh, okay, this is why. It's because, you know, politicians allow worst case scenarios to happen, and then they throw you a bone and you say, well, you know, that was a good move.
Were the feelings of these sort of existential crisis that we're in, were those hindsight feelings, or were you aware on the ground when you're in Fort McMurray of how sort of fucked up it is, that oil town is burning down kind of thing, and just sort of the irony is not a great word, but like just the sort of holy, this, you know, shitness of where we're at here. And like, were you aware of that as you're doing that? Like, what the fuck, this is a bad, you know, more than just incidental.
Yeah. I mean, everyone, again, like Fort Mac, I think the people there are amazing. And I would say that there is some irony there. I know it got blown up in the media, especially internationally, that there was a lot of irony that Fort Mac was burning down literally.
Right.
This is, this is a systemic issue of where we're at. We think that we can control nature. We think that we can rape this planet and sell off the resources without any consequences. And that doesn't mean that the industries are evil or that we need to shut things down. What we do need to think about is, what are we doing to allow for a livable planet and for safe and secure communities? And how much do we need? And how much greed are we going to allow in our society? The profits of some of these sectors that are creating some of the systemic issues that are perpetuating wildfire, flooding, droughts. It's just insane that we're allowing the money to go into these regions and not into the people's hands that need to diversify their ability to make a living. And, you know, when you look at something like Fort Mac, you see a community that has grown around a specific industry, but I mean, Fort Mac is more than that. And I think that you know, we have done a great job of I would say taking advantage of our working class people without really thinking what it means to breathe the air and to drink clean water. And this is the issues that our next generation are going to be left with. Specifically, we have an industry that is not cleaning up after itself. They like to virtue signal a lot about what they're doing, about their regulations. And the fact is, we don't have the resources and money to clean up what is going on. And all you have to do is look at the giant mine in Yellowknife to see where this is going, right? We have, you know, a taxpayer-funded cleanup program, one of the most expensive of all time. And that was left by industry that said they were going to clean up after themselves. And of course, at the end of the day, it's the taxpayer. Orphan wells are a perfect example, but what about all the tailing ponds? And as we talk about expansion of oil industry, as Rachel Notley puts on her hard hat and starts touring the oil and gas saying, yeah, I'm all for it. No one's making them pay their taxes to municipalities, and no one's actually having the hard conversations with these industries about how they're going to clean up before they talk about expansion. I think expansion needs to stop. And I think that we doesn't mean shut down everything. It means hard stop, stop the bleeding, and tell us and put the resources together that shows Albertans that they're not cleaning up for the profits that these companies have taken, that the billions and billions of dollars that these companies are profiting from, that needs to go, part of that needs to go into the cleanup of Alberta and our province, because what they're leaving behind, it's not fair. And I think that the people of this province don't deserve it.
Now, you may have just snuck in the answer to what my next question was going to be in what you just said there, but I'm going to ask it anyways, because, you know, listeners might think that it would just be a natural progression for a first responder on scenes of some of the biggest disasters in the province's history, the biggest disasters in the province's history, might just have a natural transition to something like the Green Party, but that's not actually how that went for you, right? Like you... if I remember correctly from our conversation, you were a card-carrying member of the NDP at one point?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the NDP gave me so much hope because, first of all, I'm big on democracy. So when we look at democracy, we look at the failure of our current voting system called First Past the Post. And as people saw in 2015, they'll remember Justin Trudeau saying that this would be the last election underneath this unfair colonial, basically power. It allows people who have power to keep power. This system called First Past the Post that was given to us by the UK. And, you know, just so you're aware, the UK Labour Party has now voted for proportional representation. So the country that gave us this system in the 1800s is now moving away from it. So I think it's time we move away from it. And of course, Justin Trudeau lied, and he saw that the greed of power was too strong for him to make the right decisions. And I think that that was a huge failure. And it was one of the very first indicators of who he really is as a leader. You know, it's all about him, and it's all about their power. And partisan politics creates this hyper-partisan agendas, and it creates distrust for the people. And again, moving away from that is a big deal. Now, I'm going back to your question. I'm sorry.
No problem.
I went into a huge tangent. And
Justin, not a problem.
Justin Trudeau got thrown into it. But it's like, it's funny. This what we're talking about now, and then what we're talking about cleaning up in regards to resource extraction, I have to really try to not get be angry, to not start losing it a little bit, because it's not fair and it's not right. And I think
it would actually be nice if more people couldn't get through conversations about the stuff without being angry.
Yeah. I'd be like, hey, Jordan, calm down. It's just a conversation. Right. But at the same time, it means it's the future, and it means a lot to, it should mean a lot to people.
It's literally a multi-hundred billion dollar fucking problem for just Alberta. Right. Like, it's a problem, a very, very, very big, big problem that no one seems to, everybody's solution seems to be sort of, how can we make it even easier for the companies that are already, you know, fucking us over for all of this. But
we totally are getting fucked over. Absolutely. And you can't say it any other way. I mean, when you even look at the government is effing us over, because even when you look at the orphan wells, I mean, the federal government gave us $1 billion to clean that up. It's like, case closed.
One whole billion. Thanks, guys.
Yeah. It's like, okay, you know, case closed. You should be fine. But you know, even that money didn't go into it.
Just so our listeners understand, the renovation of Parliament Hill is $5 billion. For real.
So, yeah, anyway. I mean, it's not even surprising anymore, because people are, again, it's reactive, it's this reactionary thing, and it's hard to get any buy-in for thinking about the future, which is, again, something that drove me to green politics. However, the Green Party, however, going back to the NDP, why I'm bringing this all up is because the NDP were for proportional representation, and it looked like they were going to win in a majoritarian system. So when that happened, I got freaking excited, because that was the key to unlocking a higher level of democracy where people were actually represented in parliament, or sorry, in the legislature here. And so that's when I got excited. Then I was at the time reading a lot of Naomi Klein, and a lot of the NDPers were for the Leap Manifesto. So at the same time, in around that 2015 mark, we had a party that was for proportional representation, and they were building this something called the Leap Manifesto, was literally what I just talked about. Before we expand, maybe we should think about a few things that will benefit the people and not.
Don't ask the conservatives what the Leap Manifesto says, because I'm pretty sure they think it says shut down oil and gas industry today, but whatever.
Yeah, I'm sure they say that. And
I know what they say. Yeah.
And what did Notley call it? She called it a betrayal of Alberta.
Listen.
Ripped it up. This treason.
She pandered to people that were never going to come and give her, like, she wanted to win their vote, like, out, you know, whatever it was, but they were never going to, like, fall for that. And now people like you were the ones that ended up dejected, and people like us who were like, yes, wow, we might actually make some strides in like a real progressive sense. But obviously, so when did you sort of,
so yeah,
when did so your whole excitement turn into, oh shit.
Yeah. So the hope I had, brought me into the political, because I was disenfranchised. I was sort of, you know, F them, F the system, they're not going to look after me. And then when I saw this big switch happening, I thought, oh my God, here's hope. And I got involved, and, you know, here we go. So of course, 3 months before the election, they saw the polling, the NDP quietly took the proportional representational plank out of their platform, because it now benefited them to have 100% of the power with 44% of the vote, which is undemocratic, which is ridiculous. you should do the right thing, and you should, oh my gosh. Okay. So anyways, they didn't do the right thing. Right. And they didn't do the right thing in regard to a livable planet and what was coming down the pipe with the Leap Manifesto. So what I saw was just another party that wanted to have partisan control and would pander to base voting and would pander to the votes because it was all about them getting reelected. It wasn't about them doing the right thing. Politicians generally aren't doing the right thing. They're doing what they are told to do by their leader and by the party whip. Every political party has something called the whip. If you don't know, it says you will vote in this direction. You will say these words. You will be on this agenda. Mm-hmm. The Green Party does not have a whip, never has a whip. We won't whip. We allow people to even vote against each other. So what we do is we build a very representative base. It's almost like a team of independents that allows MLAs to represent the communities that they're in. And they don't vote because Jordan said so. They vote because it's the right thing to do. It's the right thing to do for their constituents. It's a representative democracy. And so that's a big thing. Now, how did I go from NDP to Green, you ask? Well, after what I saw happen in the NDP and how they treated some of the people that I saw standing up for what was right, I said, that's enough. Forget it. If they can't figure it out, I'm done. And then I had a child. And everything changed again.
That'll change a lot for you. Yeah.
I think I could have walked into the sunset and we wouldn't be having this conversation right now, but I had a son. And when you look at your son, you say, okay, forget it. I have to get back into this. I have to get involved in democracy. I have, I have this ability to organize, to look and see what's right and wrong and make those decisions regardless of what the pressures are and what the money situation is. Because again, when we look at where the money's going, it's not for the benefit of the people. It's always generally for the benefit of industry. And I think that there's a balance that we need to find there. Now, we can get into that too, because I'm a strong proponent of a universal basic income and the eradication of poverty. And I think that that is something that we can do immediately in this lifetime. You know,
even it's weird how nobody ever wants to address poverty with giving people more money, but.
Yeah, I mean, it's the best thing. Direct give is the best thing, proven. It's not hypothetical.
What are you talking about? It led to all this inflation.
Yeah, right. Of course.
I don't know. Like, where have you been, Jordan? What the fuck? We printed money, gave it to poor people, and now you and I pay $1.60 at the tank. Like, that's how that works.
Yeah, that has nothing to do with the greed and monopolies that exist in our society. But at the same time, what they did, I mean, it's a good example. CERB is a good example of what it could do for people, what it could do for students and things like that. However, the way CERB is rolled out, the way EI and some of these benefit programs are rolled out, it keeps you from working. Whereas a universal basic income says, here you go.
Yep.
No, unconditional.
Yes.
What that does for society is it gets people back to work. People that are picking up, I know people that are picking up EI because they're just like, well, I'll just struggle and eat these sandwiches and get EI because it's too scary to go back out there and then get laid off the next week. And then I'm in this all over again. That scarcity mentality needs to stop. Universal basic income at a very low level to get people just over the poverty line is a necessity. It's pure dignity. It's giving people dignity. It's allowing people to go out and get the jobs, to get retrained. It allows people, new Canadians, to, like, imagine we have a nursing crisis right now. Imagine the new Canadians, and I'm thinking of like the Filipino communities and things like that, that they don't have the safety net to go out and get the equivalencies that they need. They already have the skills being nurses. There's so many of them. And I talk to them all the time. And it's like, yeah, well, I'll just work this job here. Meanwhile, we have a staffing crisis in our hospitals. And there's so many new Canadians that come through and they don't have the safety net to get the recertification. And even when I came from BC to Alberta, because I did my paramedics out there, it was expensive. to try to get my equivalency out here and then hold my equivalencies, just interprovincial. Think about different countries, right?
Sure.
But what I'm saying here with universal basic income is that the costs of bringing people out of poverty is nothing compared to the ability to get them back into society, to have working meaningful jobs. Your health care costs drop, the crime rates completely drop out. You're talking about you're going to solve rural crime by creating an Alberta police force. How about you work on dealing with poverty in our society and the scarcity issues?
It's funny crime. How every crime stat story that comes out talks about how much property crime is going up, and it's like, well, honest to God, like property crime would be all but eliminated with people having the things that they need. People don't usually just steal for fun. And that, yes, to the person that's listening, there is the odd hooligan, as you're saying, or whatever out there, that's just born to be a shithead. Okay. Like, no one's suggesting that like the world would just be handheld kumbaya singing, but honest to God, like the need to commit crime, removing that would remove most of crime.
Absolutely. Boom. You just hit this. Let's hit like, the systemic nails on the head instead of just, you know, throwing scapegoats at Albertans and saying we did something.
Why are we
allowing these politicians to get away with throwing crumbs at us?
Well, people always want to talk about how we can't afford this and can't afford that, and they don't ever think about like, if you eliminated this problem that we spend billions on, or this problem that we spend billions on, you would save the billions there that Boom. You are now spending on this other thing. Also, people have dignity, people have a home, people have food, all of these things. We're not robbing each other or hating on each other or all of these things. I mean, it's
right.
It seems straightforward to a lot of people, but at the same time, you know, in Alberta with our sort of like two-party system, right, that we've found ourselves in, mm-hmm. there are, you know, you're one of several parties who we've even had the leaders on the show talking about the same sort of things. We need to cut into this two-party thing, and people need to know that there's an option out there or whatever. But of course, to the people out there that vote NDP per se, there are plenty who, you know, are just NDP fans and that's what they want to vote for. But there are also others that would say to you, Jordan, your very existence makes it more likely that Danielle Smith's going to win, kind of thing, because you're going to pull votes away from the NDP, especially since we're even criticizing why we're not part of the, you know, why it is we don't both advocate for the NDP on a daily basis. If you don't push for, if we don't join Notley, all the same things are telling Barry Morishita with the Alberta Party right now, like basically you're just in the way of the NDP winning. How do we, you know, what do you say to those people? How do we actually get those people to say, like, that's not the sort of, like, to change their train of thought on that, I guess?
Okay. If I can just go back to what you said, because you nailed the crux of the whole UBI creates inflation.
Yeah.
The wasting of money is out of control. And the bureaucracy levels are out of control in our social systems and all these things. When you move money around to create more efficiency, that does not increase inflation. When you create more competition, when you create more capital for entrepreneurs, that does not rise inflation. So I just wanted to tap on that because you were
nailing it.
And we could go on more onto that too, but let's go to your question. Yeah, Jordan, you're in the way. You're in the way, man. What am I in the way of? I'm in the way of this two-party system that we've created here in Alberta. I'm not in the way of anything when you think about the fact that 40% of Albertans don't even vote. They're not represented. They're completely disenfranchised. Why are they disenfranchised, Scott? Well, it's because they don't have anyone good to vote for. So why would I care about getting in the way of one bad choice or another bad choice? Or the fact that if you pick one of these choices because they're so hyperpartisan, you basically neglect a large group of people that are saying, well, you know what? This doesn't line up with my values. what I'm giving people, which is different than Barry Morishita and the Alberta Party or any other party, what I'm giving them is another option. And it's time for us to mainstream what proportional representation can do for our province, because we already had proportional representation in Alberta. This isn't Jordan's making up crazy green ideologies.
we can do that too, though.
We had it from 23 to 55, right? And you're like, well, that's ancient history. Well, what about the 1800s? That's not ancient history, because that's the electoral system that we have today. Why did we stop having proportional representation in Alberta? Because the Social Credit Party said, this is too complicated for voters.
This might help us not win.
Yeah. And they went from I can't remember what the seat change was, but it was drastic. They had 95% of the seats in the next election after they switched back to a first past the post system, because what it does is it allows people who have power and money to manipulate the vote to ensure that they get more seats. But when you have proportional representation, you can have an Alberta Party. Mr. Barry Morishita can be waving his hand in the legislature. You can have the NDP and you can have a UCP. And what it does is it also, you can have a Green Party. We can have people that are standing up for inequality and education, because that's what proportional representation does in countries and regions around the world. It allows for less inequality, higher environmental protection. It allows for a stronger economy, less flip-flopping. And I had to learn the name of this, policy lurch, which is, I was like, oh, there is a name for this.
Yes.
That's absolutely. When the NDP built some castles, sand castles in their little, on their beach or in their sandbox. And some of them are good sandcastles and some of them kind of suck. But then what happens is the next party comes in, they've got majority on, less than the general vote. They kick down everything and they build their own. So that creates instability within our economic system. You can have parties work together. It happens all around the world in developed countries with similar economies and populations as us. And I think that we can now think about something like what we had back in the 50s before it was destroyed and say, we're not creating something new. We're going back to the fact that we stood up for our freedoms and our democracies. We're going back to when we were leaders, when Alberta was a leader in democracy, when we were on the forefront of giving people more freedom and more power and franchising people to make decisions that are representative of their value system. So, long story short, why vote green? Well, this is the guarantee. And I've even gone far enough to say that if we had enough seats in the legislature, we would legislate proportional representation and we would have immediately have another election under the new system, a fair election, a democratic system under the first past the post, not under first past the post, but under proportional representation. And what system, what type of proportional representation? Personally, I think that should be decided by direct democracy. And that means a citizens assembly, something that's happening all over the world. Again, if we want to be leaders in democracy, if we want to talk about our freedoms, Albertans, freedoms.
We can scream about them if we want to.
That's a direct democracy where we're utilizing citizens assembly to choose, especially things like how should people get elected? Do you think the Stanley Cup champions should be asked what the rules should be for the next season after they win? Do you think that it'll be fair for all the teams that are playing?
That's a fucking great analogy, by the way.
No one in their right minds would allow that to happen, right?
Yep.
So why are we allowing that to happen in our society on things that dictate who gets what resources in our society? I mean, this is madness. And I think that when we speak out to this, we don't have to be, this doesn't have to be a complicated situation. We can vote another option. NDP or UCP, block the people you hate the most. Is that democracy? No, that is bullshit. And when someone gives you another option that is proven, that exists all around the world, that even existed in Alberta until it was destroyed, let's choose it. let's take a leap and let's actually make systemic change in our society happen. And so that's where I say F strategic voting, F your first past the post, BS games, like what's going on with by-elections and crap, like what happened in Brooks Medicine Hat. It's just first past the post games. That all ends when you change the system, when you change the voting system. All this fundraising and creating an enemy to fundraise against, Kenny's bad, Smith is bad, Notley's bad. It just allows people to just perpetuate this fundraising against. I'll protect you from this other person. And that's where we need to stop. And we need to say, okay, hold on, Alberta. What's our proportional representation in this province? And what does that actually look like? Because people are not voting for what they believe in. They're voting, as you said, because they want to block someone else. And that doesn't mean vote NDP, right? That should mean if you want to change, you want to change the voting system. And that's something that we can guarantee.
Well, and it also, like, it seems like it, first of all, it creates less discussion. Obviously, a lot less gets talked about in the legislature just by having the two party, like one party and the opposition party. You're basically only talking about like what the government wants to talk about at any given time, really, right? Like the topics never fucking change for one, right? And then you also sort of end up having these parties become more one and the same. Like we had like the Liberals and the Conservatives were for so long at the federal level, and maybe not quite as close now that we're going full goddamn like insane at the Conservative level, but like the Liberals have always been kind of a right-leaning party, whether people want to call them progressive or not. And what I'm saying here is like, it, you know, the NDP, like, I've always wondered why they made the decision to be so fucking pro oil and gas in Alberta. Like there's supporters of the NDP that think that they have to shill for oil because that's the only way to win an election in Alberta, whatever. But what is your take on that? Because the way I see it is because there's only these two parties going, they're both trying to be the same on the things that they think Albertans all want, and then different on like these other few things where, and it just limits everything.
It limits everything. Nailed it. Because really it's just about votes. It's not even about doing the right thing, like I said. So what are they following? They're following votes and money, right? Fundraising money. They're going to pay back their buddies once they get elected. They're going to do favors. And they're going to just keep rattling their saber and to ensure that their base will vote, or people who are afraid enough, because this is all fear-based campaigns. So, you know, that's tough, because when you, like, for example, with the Green Party, we talk about green jobs, we talk about diversification, we talk about a lot of things that actually don't necessarily represent what we are trying to say. We talk about, for example, my deputy leader, she was oil and gas. She's moved over to the green sector. She wants one of our big messaging points to be green jobs. And that sounds like we're coming for your livelihood, Albertans. We're coming for your livelihood, right?
That's what they'll talking say about it.
That's what they will say about it. And it kind of sounds like that, right? But what we're, and that's why it's so tricky. What we are saying is we can add green jobs. The green industry is growing. The renewable issues are real. They're not perfect situations. However, the subsidization of certain industries in our province, being it oil and gas, those are things that now shouldn't be on the table when we look at the future of Alberta industry. And I think that these political parties are too scared to move away from that. And because there's so much money going into subsidizing certain industries, and I think that the amount of sort of culture built around that is dictating them to, like you said, shill for a certain oil and gas industry and work with certain companies and things like that. But when you take away the majoritarian systems like first past the post, it allows for a larger conversation to happen about where the funding is going and where the resources should be going. And it creates accountability and it creates transparency. Because right now, even when I talk about that $1 billion that went to clean up the orphan wells, no one really knows where it went. I mean, it went into some oil company's revenue stream, and nothing really happened. But it's terrible to see the mismanagement of our resources and how that will create so much issues for the next generation, including the fact that they just said that the Heritage Fund is now not getting some of the surplus, and we've learned nothing from, you know, what Norway's done with their Heritage Fund and how they've diversified their economy and gotten away from boom and bust. And so I don't know if this is answering your question specifically, but I think that it's what I'm speaking to is, like, why do they always go back to the this base thing? And it's because the political system says that you have to. If you want to win, you have to play ball. And you have to take it, and you have to put on your little hard hat and your fancy little gloves, and you have to go out and walk around and say, I'm not going to shut you down because of this and that.
And, like, but while I'll concede that every political party that gets into power tends to sort of realize, oh my God, now we want to stay in power, that doesn't mean that Rachel Notley and the NDP didn't do that when they got in, when they won. They definitely tried to appease the other side. They just fucking did. You know, and you could say that's a great, hey, that's working together, and that's what Albertans should do. That's an okay opinion to have, you know, but it doesn't change the fact that Notley for sure spent more time trying to win votes from her opposition side than she did trying to appease anyone that would be considered an actual leftist in this province, or somebody that would be looking for actual social reform in this province. Those people were far more ignored than anyone, right? And we're always catering to, and that's where it sort of gets annoying from my standpoint, is that, like, we're constant, yes, I get it, you want to Albertans to vote for you. I'm not saying you shouldn't try to get my conservative, small C conservative neighbor to vote for you or whatever. I like, do what you got to do. But there seems to be this sort of, like, complete willingness for even those people that would support the NDP. There's this willingness to just sort of let certain things go because anything is better than Smith, you know, a UCP led province. And, like, we can have that argument at election time too, but it doesn't change the fact that it's getting us fucking nowhere. This constant need to just sort of, like, avoid the monster keeps us spinning our goddamn hamster wheel like a bunch of dummies.
Preach.
Can I be in the party?
Yes. Speaking of which, speaking of which, we would love to see some more involvement. We've got one candidate down in Medicine Hat, Cypress, but we don't have a Medicine Hat Brooks candidate yet. If you're listening to this Forgotten Corner podcast and you want to get involved, you want to represent what we're talking about here with proportional representation and making real shifts so that people can do the hard things that people under this current system. You will never see a UBI. You will never see any sort of meaningful environmental protection. Keep dreaming, Alberta, because they won't do anything. They won't take a chance. They will spin their wheel, just as Scotty said, and it's bull, because they won't do anything dangerous that would not allow them to keep power. And by not doing anything, they do even more damage to democracy. You have lower and lower voter turnout. Only time people come out to vote is when they're really scared. Yep. You saw a lot of people come out just to get Notley out.
Yep.
Right? NDP didn't win in 2015 because they were so amazing. They won because the PCs were so corrupt. And Redford was so embarrassing for them that people.
And the Wild Rose had just turned off everybody in the province with their floor cross, right? Like for in sure. Medicine Hat, we had an absolute wingnut running for the Wild Rose. a floor crosser from the Wild Rose who was now running for the PCs, and Bob Warner from the NDP won with 39% of the vote to become Speaker of the Legislature. So 39% of the vote won the election. That's not everybody. And I mean, it was, hey, listen, like Medicine Hat's got 40% people that might be progressive. That's interesting. But it doesn't change the fact that they needed circumstances on the other side in order to win. No different than the CPC at the federal level absolutely needs the NDP and the Liberals to split some level of a vote in order for them to win, because the the highest loved party, no matter who it is, Liberals or CPC, is always in around like 32 to 36% support.
Right, because people are so fed up with this bullshit. And like you said, like, it's, again, people just aren't showing up. People aren't showing up to vote. And the amount of oppositional garbage, and people are so tired of the NDP and the UCP just going at it and just not talking about any solutions whatsoever. They're like, oh, we got a free ticket now. We don't have to talk about any solutions. We can just rage on the opposition, and we can just rage on the leader, and it's getting us nowhere. And then federally, look at what you've done now, Justin, by not putting in proportional representation. Now you're giving an in to the conservatives to come back in power with a false majority.
Yep.
You could have Pierre as the next prime minister with a 40% vote. Is that what we want, Albertans?
Maybe. I mean, some of them do.
Some of them are like, rah, rah. Okay,
might
great.
Be as big as base.
That would be want Canada?
Probably. Right? No, of course not. I mean, 65% of the country doesn't want that.
Right. But does Pierre make some good points? Yes.
Easy to be opposition. Like, he's not like the criticisms of Trudeau are fair some of the time. Do you know what I mean? I can't handle the fact that I'm constantly feeling like I'm defending that guy, because I'm talking to people that are like, out of control spending led to inflation, printing money. And I'm always like, no, fuck, that's not how that works. Yeah. And then it sounds like I'm like this huge Trudeau fan. And I always feel like I have to disclaim that, like, just
right. That
I'd love to have a discussion about why I don't like Justin Trudeau with somebody that doesn't like him for the same reasons, like, electoral reform, for a great example.
Exactly.
Probably the biggest example that you want to talk about broken, you know, promises or whatever. And this is the thing, is like, we're constantly told that we have to fall in line. It would just be better if those of you that like, nothing gets you more in more shit. Ask like Kim Seaver. I don't know if you've ever spoken to him, but like, you want to fucking lose some followers or take some shit online, like, lightly, barely criticize Justin Trudeau, or God forbid Chrystia Freeland, and just watch it come. And it's just like, in that one area, how the fuck are you better than the other side? Honest to God, like, constantly I'm talking to conservative friends here or whatever, people here, and I'm like, how can you not? Can you not just stop and criticize your own shit for 2 seconds? Like, don't you think it's at least bad that you share the same views as the guy that waves the Nazi flag? Like, you can't say that that's a bad thing. You always have to defend everything. Then you turn around and it's like, well, you know, the other side does it entirely.
Oh yeah. Like, there's this righteousness of political identity is just absolutely out of control right now.
Yeah.
And so you'll notice, right? Like, right now I'm not hyper-partisan on the Greens. I think that the biggest thing that the Greens are doing right is that they're thinking about the future. And I think that that should be an important part of the way we act as politicians. We shouldn't just be reactive. Oh, we've created a worst case scenario, but I'm going to give you this subsidy or throw you this bone. And then everyone goes, good job.
Phew.
Everyone in your party. And then across the floor, they're yelling at you because you can't say anything right. There is no, like, it's crazy. Like, right now, actually, I'm sitting down with a UCP staffer and I'm going, let's go back over these last few years and, like, tell me all the good things that you think. Like, this is a person that I really I trust. And I think that this person, she's very smart. And I'm just like, what in the past few years has been good that's come out of the UCP and what in the past few years has been good that's come out of the NDP, what ideas. You know, it's amazing that we cannot admit this as a political party or a leader that anyone's done anything good ever. And how is this going to get us past this, the hardships that Albertans feel on the street and that they feel in their homes, trying to make sure they have food on the table and can pay their rent? Until we can come together and stop playing these political games, then we are not serving Albertans. So anyone who says that they are is just talking nonsense. And again, like I said, you want to say that everything that bad happened was because of Trudeau or Notley. Like, come on.
Yeah.
In what world are you living in?
Right.
That these people have single-handedly changed the price of crude oil. Or
it just ruins the conversation. Like I said, like, I'd love to talk to these people about why I don't think Trudeau should be prime minister anymore. Like, I'm on that. I don't think anyone should do the job for 10 more than 10 years. So 2025, no. I don't even think he should be running. That's my personal opinion. I think it should change. And like, I don't think people should be in power for that long. That's just the way I feel about it. Feel however you want about it. But it kills the fucking conversation altogether, right? Like, when we, you're not allowed to, just, it makes me so frustrated. I want to wrap up with you, but I do want to ask you a couple, I do want to quickly ask you just with the Green Party, because you're at about, 20 candidates right now. Presumably we're looking at a May election here. Sort of what's the sort of itinerary for you guys in the next coming months?
Yeah, cool. Thanks for asking. We are, and I don't know if it's official yet. We've put them into the database, but we've got 24 candidates.
24. Nice.
Yeah. So we're creeping up on the UCP there. they've got, I think, 36 right now confirmed for the next election. And I think Alberta Party has 3. So there's a big gap going on right there. The people that are showing up are incredible. They're everyday Albertans. I'm not asking for your lawyer papers. I'm not asking for your career politician status. I'm asking for real Albertans like myself to stand up and to do, you know, to get involved in democracy. And the people that are showing up are amazing. We have a large percentage of the candidates are BIPOC, which is really great because, again, a community that's been very disenfranchised in the political realm. And I think that it's amazing to see people standing up and taking power back. And I think that it's really exciting to see people that, you know, are newer to politics come in with fresh ideas and not jaded from the games and the system of partisan bullshit. And so what we have is something very fresh. And the Green Party has had a completely rebuild because we were destroyed in 2008. We had to like fight to get our name back. I mean, I wasn't part of this. We had a lot of amazing people be part of this. And when I came involved, it was like, we were just kind of sitting a little bit stagnant and not really going for the seats in the legislature. And that's all shifted. We've got a team that is young and exciting. We've had people come over from the Alberta Liberals, knowing that they didn't have their, I was going to say shit together. I'll just say it. They don't have.
We've sworn enough on today's show.
I think we're there. Yeah. And the people that are looking for fresh options that are going to speak to, especially the youth vote. So again, we've got a lot of young people showing up. And so what's next for us is we're going to keep moving towards a full slate. We've got a lot of people coming up as nominated candidates. So that's really exciting. We should have, you know, 30 pretty soon. And then we're just out there reintroducing ourselves, reintroducing our brand. Why participatory democracy is so important, right? Why a strong democracy is so important. So when you think Greens in Alberta, you're generally thinking tree huggers. But now there's a first responder disaster manager as the leader, and they've got this, you know, massive income of young candidates and people that have been disenfranchised. And what are they doing differently? And I think that when we can really show that the electoral reform issue is enough to break strategic voting, then that's when we've done our job. That's when I've done my job as leader. Not that it's a job, it's all volunteer. we don't have any staffers. We're all volunteer. Why aren't we out there fundraising our asses off? Is because
what, you don't get a salary as the leader?
Don't get a salary. We're doing it because we love it. We're doing it because we want to see a change. We're doing it because we care about our children and the people that are on the street that can't eat because policy is not allowing them to. It's a decision that we can make, Alberta, to shift away from the crumbs that have been given to us by these politicians and by these parties spinning their wheels on a first past the post system and making sure that they get reelected instead of looking out for all Albertans. And there's a diverse voice in Alberta. You can't say that one party is going to match all those different voices. I'm not going to say that the Green Party values are more important than your values or more important than anyone else's, but they do exist. And there's so many people in Alberta that want to vote Green, but they don't because of strategic issues with the voting system or vote other parties. But what we can do is we can come together and form a more accountable and collaborative legislature that speaks to the diverse values of Albertans. And I think that if we are going to see any big shifts in the way we deal with crime, with poverty, with environmental protection, with our economy, then we have to make a big shift towards a proportional representational voting system. And that's where we start. And that's the beginning. And that's why we think that we really deserve your vote in the next election, because we're fighting for all Albertans to have a stronger democracy. And I think that that serves everyone. And I think that we can do it.
I mean, partisan politics aside, like it's hard to argue with most of those points. Those are all things that we as a show advocate for. So I don't know. I guess we work for the Green Party now since it's volunteer. We're all part of this, but it's a great place to wrap the show. But I think our listeners can understand that, like, we've had numerous party leaders and politicians on the show, but the passion that Jordan feels is obviously, I think, coming right through into your earphones today. And if there's one thing we can say, like, you really obviously have like a deep burning feel for like a better Alberta, and something that has, you know, without doing everything sort of the same, how do we get better with the same old, which gets so goddamn tiresome. So we're really, really appreciate you being like that and being candid and whatnot. Tell our listeners just where they can find you and the Green Party before I let you go.
Yeah. The best thing to do is just check out our website, albertagreens.ca. And of course, we're on Twitter and Facebook, but, you know, check out our website, see what our priorities are, see where we're headed for the next election, get involved. We'd love to see people just come out. We're doing town halls biweekly. We've got lots of candidates meetings if you want to just check it out and see what it means to step up and do your thing for democracy. You know, let's join something new. Let's be fresh. Let's ensure that when we put our time and effort into something, that we get something back. And that means we got to mainstream a lot of these issues around proportional representation and a universal basic income to eradicate poverty. And I'm really just so excited and honored to have been speaking to you this long, Scott, and appreciate the time that you guys have put into it. And you guys are not forgotten down in Medicine Hat. I'm hoping that we can have a lot more conversations. And I understand that Dustin Cartwright might be on your show pretty soon.
We're going to make that happen. Yep.
And he's the candidate down in Medicine Hat, Cypress. So I'm really excited again to have this opportunity.
We're very, very, very much looking forward to the card, Cartwright versus Barnes in the upcoming election. We'll let Dustin tell the stories about why that's going to be so great. But when I saw who you guys chose as your candidate in Cyprus, I was like, well, I fucking like the cut of these guys' jib. That's all I can say. Good for you guys. So listen, yeah, we'll stop, rubbing each other's backs here and get out of everybody's way. But again, thank you so much. Listen, folks, it's a time in the show where we thank those of our patrons who go above and beyond anything we could ever imagine. Tefera Chaudhry, Nicola DiNicola, Chris Sturwald, Dave Bond Miller, Darius Beauregard. Honestly, you guys, couldn't do this show without you guys. To all of our other patrons, seriously, you keep us going. You pay the bills, so we really appreciate that. And to everyone, just thanks for coming out. We'll have some links in the show notes there where you guys can find Jordan and find the Green Party. And we'll see you guys in a week or two. Actually, next week, because we have another guest planned. So, all right. Take care, guys. Thanks.